English National Opera, he's brought us to Bell Percussion, where you can find everything from mallets and marimbas to timpani, drum kits, cymbals, and a whole lot more.
So, to my right is a wind machine. And the wind machine is a large drum made of wooden slats, which around which is stretched a piece of canvas. And there's a handle at one end so that I can turn the drum around, rather like someone drawing a tombola at a village fete. But when the slats rub against the canvas, it gives you this sound. The faster you turn it, the more frantic it gets. And that's exactly the sound that you'll hear in the Alpine Symphony.
Of all the storms in classical music, none is arguably more chillingly real than the one we get hit with in Richard Strauss's Alpine Symphony. As a boy, Strauss was part of a group of climbers who lost their way in the Alps, caught in a violent storm while they were heading up a mountain. Strauss's memory, transformed into a musical evocation of that experience, takes us through every stage of a storm, from the ominous drum roll at the start, little raindrops, flashes of lightning, and then there's a wind machine as we get into the eye of the storm itself. Mick Doran again.
The Alpine Symphony. The storm in there not only has got this enormous orchestra and creating an extraordinary effect through the use of conventional instruments, but he then puts the icing on the cake with a wind machine and a thunder sheet. And so it's all there in that one. This huge sheet of metal here is a thunder sheet. And it's made of aluminium, very fine aluminium. It's very flexible. If I bend it with my hands, you see it's very flexible. It's about 6 foot long and approximately 3 foot wide. And what I do is hold the edge towards the centre and wobble it. And so it does a pretty good impersonation of distant thunder. And again, like the wind machine, the more excited you get playing it, the more excited the sound comes out. I think it's an amazing piece. I was very lucky to perform it at the Festival Hall. And I was playing the wind machine. And I sat waiting for the storm, which is about halfway through the piece, sitting behind the French horn section. I've never experienced anything like it. The sheer drama of being in the middle of this enormous, huge machine that's pumping out a fantastic sound, beautiful music that goes from the quietest pianissimo to the loudest fortissimo. And it's such an extraordinary piece of music, one of my favourites.
Lightning, quite often the piccolo is used for lightning. And
why? Because it's high and shrieky.
It's shrieky, yeah. I mean, not that, of course, lightning makes a sound, but I think if you've ever been close to a thunderstorm, you'll know that it can get a little bit scary because thunder and lightning, the reason that they happen at different times is because sound and light move at different speeds. So light moves very quickly, so you see the lightning, then you hear the thunder later. So the difference between the thunder and the lightning tells you how far away the storm is. So if you're too close to a thunderstorm, the thunder and lightning will be very close together. So in the Alpine Symphony, Strauss has what I think must be a lightning bolt with a shrieky piccolo, and then almost immediately a big clap of thunder, and that really sums up the kind of, that's a bit close for comfort. You know, you might imagine your hair standing on end, perhaps because you're in the electric field of the thunderstorm.
Richard Strauss wasn't the only musician who needed the extremes of a particular climate to inspire him. Composers from across Europe and the States have often found that when there's low pressure, it induces a kind of composing frenzy. I wondered, though, if there was a particular kind of climate that made the perfect musical storm. Just how much does it matter if the storms you experience are violent and climactic, or just damp and miserable? Karen Applin.
There are two major different types of storm in weather and in the types of storms represented in music. So we have convective storms and frontal storms. So a convective storm is the type of storm that will generate thunder and lightning, which is usually due to it being a warm day and the air rising and there being lots of motion in the air and eventually a big thundercloud developing. The other type of storm, the frontal storm, is more to do with the bigger weather systems. We get a lot of them in the UK coming in off the Atlantic. So when you see the weather and you see the isobars packed close together and the fronts, that is the frontal type of storm. And that quite often comes in from the west into northern Europe and brings wind and rain, occasionally thunder and lightning, but usually just wind and rain.
So Richard Strauss is always going to give you a convective storm and Benjamin Britten's always going to give you a frontal storm.
That is what we found.
The Storm from Peter Grimes is a piece that we do a lot, actually. It's often done as an encore by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And I must say, I've never become tired of it. It always seems so original. The rhythms and the way the phrases are broken up, you know, that's very exciting. Also, the orchestration is absolutely immaculate. There's that little stretto all the time, you know, as we say, where the rhythms gather speed. This effect of the waves, you know, lashing in sort of contrary directions. And then there's a wonderful bit that I always look forward to. I always get slightly sort of goose pimply feeling in when the trombones are playing da-da-da-dee, da-da-da-dee-dum, da-da-da-dee. And it's very close harmony, low down, and that's really like, you know, this tremendous swell.
The Storm from the 4C Interludes from Peter Grimes is a musical storm. It's aggressive, but it's still musical. You haven't got someone clapping a thunder sheet or winding up a wind machine. But it's very possible to create a very dramatic storm without using any effects, just using conventional musical instruments.
My personal favourite is the Peter Grimes Storm. I think that's really original. And I think Britten was quite constrained in instrumentation he could use because he was writing for a pit orchestra. And there's a very sort of British type of weather represented, which is the kind of, oh, it's been raining, it's been terrible all day. Oh, it's a bit brighter now. And then for about 5 minutes, oh, it's raining again. And there is a moment of that. I think that's really original.
I have recently heard those Britten Sea interludes in the concert hall again for the first time in ages, and I'd forgotten how ferocious the storm is that Britten unleashes on us, a brilliant allegory for the emotional turbulence of his operatic anti-hero Peter Grimes. And it's this question of what life is going to throw at us that we all ask ourselves every day, and that a great depiction of a musical storm goes some way to answering. No wonder such a staggeringly wide range of composers have created their own storms in music. Everyone from Dvorak, Grieg, Mendelssohn and Liszt to Gershwin, Glazunov, Bax and Purcell. And it is not just instrumental music that gets to whip itself up into a frenzy. How about this chorus? It's from one of Handel's Chandos anthems, and it turns the words of a psalm into a fizzingly dramatic evocation of a storm. The quotation reads, "The earth trembled and quaked, the very foundations also of the hills shook and removed. He cast forth lightnings and gave his thunder and destroyed them." If I had to pick a favourite, I have always particularly loved The Storm from Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. The way it slowly reveals that dark weather brewing on the horizon. There are deep rumblings in the basses and cellos, then the violins come in with these little offbeat figures like raindrops falling. And then suddenly it's over our heads, the timps, the full orchestra raging, and then it subsides. There's the warm softness of a flute like rays of sunshine. But does it actually ring true to someone who knows how real storms behave? Well, I talked to BBC weatherman Stav Danaos, and I asked him which musical storms rang truest for him.
They always often start off quite quiet and formidable sounds. That feeling of the sky darkening, the air falling, lights. So after a sunny, warm day, suddenly dark clouds begin to build. Feel that oppressive feeling of a storm building, and the music's got to depict that really. And then as the storm begins to approach, with distant thunder becoming like getting louder, lightning strikes becoming visible, first few drops of rain coming down, then the rain in full force lashing with a strong wind, close lightning strikes. So that's when I think the music should be at full speed, really loud, dramatic, piercing at points, and then beginning to taper off as well. But you get the whole scene of the rain lashing, the roads turning to rivers, flash flooded, brown.
The Grand Canyon, pounded by thunder and lightning during a nighttime desert storm. That was the cloudburst from Ferdi Grofe's Grand Canyon Suite, a highly realistic and I think utterly brilliant portrayal of a storm from a 20th century master of orchestration. So, who in the end is the stormiest composer? Certainly one Baroque musician has a reasonable claim to that title.
Vivaldi was the... I counted up the storm composers. Vivaldi wrote the most storms, and he did both types, which I think is probably because Italy gets both types of weather, because it's got a long coastline, so it gets the storm at sea type, and then also the inland frontal storm. In the Four Seasons, he's got... I think there's a storm in spring and in summer, and I think they're both the thunder and lightning type. But then he wrote the storm at sea, which was another orchestral piece, which is clearly the frontal type. And then he had a vocal piece. That's about a storm at sea, I think, as well, so that's the frontal type.
So So there you have it, your indispensable guide to how to cook up the perfect musical storm. Look up to the mountains and down into the canyons if you want ferocious turbulence. If you live in wet and windy Britain, start genning up on your frontal storms. Never panic when you get lost in the Alps. It's great musical material. And never hold back on using a wind machine or the odd thunder sheet if you want to create maximum impact. Actually, on second thoughts, maybe best to hold back on that thunder sheet, as Mick Doran explains.
Of course, there's a famous storm scene in The Flying Dutchman, which I had a bit of a moment on. There was a very attractive lady backstage who I was trying to impress. And we'd finished, it was hugely successful. And as I walked away, I was still looking at this young lady and trying to show off a bit. I tripped over the edge of the stand holding the thunder sheet and fell flat on my face. Not only did I very much not impress her, I also did not impress the conductor.
Percussionist Mick Doran, and let's hope that tonight produces no such inadvertent thunderclaps. Stormy Weather was presented by Susie Klein and produced by Simon Elms. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, Petroc Trelawney with you, BBC National Orchestra of Wales, back on the platform. Like the Szymanowski that we heard before the interval, Strauss required a large orchestra for his Alpine Symphony, which is next tonight. Includes an offstage hunting party of 12 horns, 2 trumpets and 2 trombones, and an array of percussion to summon up the storm. I'm looking directly at the thunder sheet, in fact, which looks reasonably stable at the moment. Written in 1915, the symphony depicts a day's climbing in the Alps, trumpets and tubas outlining the looming mountain, glorious vision in emerging sunlight as dawn breaks. Cello and double basses present a march-like theme as we begin the climb. Later come meadows and pasture, waterfalls and glaciers, and finally the summit. But all is not over. A thunderstorm soaks our hero before he begins his descent. Well, Thomas Sondergaard is passionate about Strauss's music and will perform much of it during his tenure with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. He is a Dane and delighted for this opportunity to don his climbing boots.
Let me put it this way. Denmark is not a country of wild hills. It's very flat. And if there's anything that's really dramatic described in this score, it's the Alps. And we don't see much of that up in Denmark. And not least the way that he, with big forces, uses the thought of actually reaching the top of the hill. But then this beautiful way that he describes that when we've reached the top, how does that feel? It's suddenly very quiet, and you get this beautiful oboe solo, completely alone, with a little tremolo in the strings. And then I must say, there are moments in this tone poem that just makes me feel closer to God. There really is. Right before the sunset, or actually in the sunset in the piece, coming back to the night again, which closes the concert, is one of the most beautiful moments that Strauss ever wrote, I think.
Thomas Sondergaard, and the stage is set as he makes his way onto the Royal Albert Hall platform to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in an Alpine Symphony by Richard Strauss. An Alpine Symphony by Richard Strauss, Thomas Sondergaard conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. A journey up and down a mountain. There was the great Strauss expert Michael Kennedy says to approach this work merely as a travelogue of 24 hours in the mountains is to overlook the awareness throughout of an elemental power, a mystical and pantheistic response to nature. Tim Thorpe, principal horn, takes a bow in the horn section standing now. 132 players in total on the stage this evening, 16 extra brass players in the balcony as the offstage hunting party. Philip Schwartz, principal trumpet, percussion, the cowbells, spread earlier on in various gangways and entrance points here at the Royal Albert Hall. Robert Plain, principal clarinetist. David Cowley, principal oboist. Strauss worked on an Alpine Symphony in May 1911. News came through of the death of his friend Mahler. He was unable to speak for days. Unlike Mahler, though, Strauss took no comfort from fate. He talked about calling an Alpine Symphony the Antichrist, because there is in it, he said, a moral purification through one's own strength, deliverance through labour, worship of nature, eternal and magnificent. Well, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales back here next Wednesday when Jacques Van Steen conducts Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. English first half, Elgar, Walton and Bantok. Tomorrow night, the first of two eagerly awaited concerts by the orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia, Rome, and music director Sir Antonio Papano. Now, though, Thomas Sondergaard is back on the platform, taking a bow at the rostrum, making his proms debut as a conductor tonight. Worth pointing out, he has appeared on this stage before. He was a percussionist in the European Community Youth Orchestra, performing Bruckner 8 in 1989 with Bernard Haitink conducting. Now he's back as the new principal conductor of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. For now, from the Royal Albert Hall, good night. Back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Patrick Trelawney, thank you very much. I think I was at that prom in 1989. I suddenly feel very old. Well, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Radio 3 on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And, of course, don't forget, every prom is available for you to listen to again for 7 days via the Radio 3 website. And you may like to know that over on BBC4 Television, Thursday, Friday and Sunday evenings are when you can watch coverage of the proms on throughout the summer. This evening, our colleagues on BBC4 have been showing the BBC Philharmonic's concert from Tuesday night, featuring the remarkable young Japanese pianist Nobuyuki Tsuji playing Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, also featuring Nielsen's Inextinguishable Symphony. Do have a look at the BBC iPlayer if you'd like to see that concert. Well, as Patrick said, tomorrow night is the first of two proms in this weekend, celebrating Verdi.
At the BBC Proms and live on BBC Radio 3, Viva Verdi! The second in a pair of concerts from Sir Antonio Papano and the orchestra of the Rome Academy of Santa Cecilia includes the four sacred pieces and from the Requiem, the dramatic Liberame. Saturday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Well, what I meant to say was, of course, first of two concerts given by the Orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia with Antonio Papano. Their first concert tomorrow night, Mozart's Hafner Symphony, Schumann's Piano Concerto, played by Jan Lisicki, and after the interval, Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. And an even earlier than usual start tomorrow night, 6:30. That's because we have two proms tomorrow night. And the second of them is a late-night concert given by Ex Cathedra, music by Stockhausen at 10:15 tomorrow night. Well, next tonight, in a quarter of an hour, another chance to hear a feature first broadcast last year telling the story of the Victorian writer of penny dreadful novels George W.M. Reynolds, dubbed The Other Dickens. Learn more about his story at 9:15. Then we have jazz from some of our new generation artists at 10 o'clock. And we continue our essay series, The Piano in Five Pieces, at 10:45 tonight. So before our feature at 9:15, a little more from the great outdoors. And if you don't quite have a head for the alpine heights, how about the relative safety of standing on a rock in the company of Schubert, Der Hirt auf dem Felsen, The Shepherd on the Rock. Nancy Argenta is the soprano here, with Melvin Tan playing the forte piano. The obbligato clarinet part is played by Eric Hoprick.
Thank you.
Schubert's great ambition, of course, was to write operas. Just imagine how much poorer the song repertoire would have been if he'd succeeded. Well, the two worlds came as close together as they ever did in his very last composition, which we heard there, The Shepherd on the Rock. Mozart's opera La Clemenza di Tito had famously paired the female voice with the clarinet, and that was Schubert following suit. Nancy Argento was the soprano, Melvin Tan played the fortepiano, and the clarinet part was played by Eric Hoprecht. Well, we've got time for another Schubert song from Nancy Argenta and Melvin Tan. Now, without the aid of a clarinet this time, this is Nacht und Träume, Night and Dreams. It speaks upliftingly of dreams filtering through the minds of sleeping mortals as the moonlight filters through their homes, and of the sense of loss when those mortals wake up again. Schubert's Nacht und Träume, sung by Nancy Argento with Melvin Tan playing the fortepiano. This is BBC Radio 3. We've jazz from our new generation artists at 10 o'clock, an essay on the piano at 10:45, and then Max Reinhardt is here with Late Junction at 11. Now, though, at almost 17 minutes past nine, another chance to hear a feature first broadcast last year. as we take you back to the dark streets and the even darker deeds of the fringes of Victorian society, the fictional world of George W. M. Reynolds, a best-selling novelist and political activist who, in his lifetime, outsold his great rival, the author of The Pickwick Papers. Lawrence Scott now tells the story of the other Dickens.
I've come to the heart of Paris because the life and works of George Reynolds is very much a tale of two cities, and indeed the French capital provided a cradle for all of his subsequent activities, be it journalism or fiction or radical politics.
A very pleasant diversion this is too, thought Mr. Weller within himself, as the sledge glided over the hard snow with a precipitation that afforded a considerable degree of amusement to the crowds of foot passengers that were assembled on the boulevard. "I'll master him yet," said Mr. Pickwick, in an agony of fear. The rate at which the three adventurous travellers were now proceeding would have brought them in about 5 minutes to the Place de la Bastille, but on the very summit of the hill whence a pleasing view of the Porte Saint-Denis is afforded to the spectator, the sledge encountered a ponderous omnibus and immediately overturned, the unfortunate trio of great men being precipitated into the quiet and undisputed seclusion of a large heap of snow that had accumulated by drifting on one side of the road. As is usual in such cases, the horse stood perfectly still and doubtless pondered on the ruins he had caused.
Reynolds's years in Paris really culminated in his first literary success, which was Pickwick Abroad, A Tour in France, his own appropriation of Dickens's highly popular character.
He's regarded as something of an enigma. I see Reynolds as a very dynamic, passionate, extrovert individual, tremendous amount of energy. I mean, he's a very colourful character, you can certainly say that. I don't know if I go as far as say eccentric, but he's certainly a very colourful character.
Ian Haywood is a professor of English literature at the University of Roehampton. Like Ian, I discovered George Reynolds while researching Victorian popular fiction. Now, the first thing that strikes you is how the posthumous Reynolds is so utterly emaciated compared to the ruddy, corpulent reputation he enjoyed and endured in his day. In a broad sense, Reynolds's disappearance is a chilly essay in our own temporariness. Few of us seem spared from time's amnesia once you realise how quickly this loud life has fallen quiet.
I mean, he was a kind of renegade from the upper middle classes and went to Paris and got involved in the cultural scene in Paris in the 1830s after the revolution. He became a passionate republican and he was, you know, in this kind of swirl of publishing and politics at this very interesting moment in English cultural history, when really, you know, what's at stake here is the kind of moral, political and aesthetic condition of the English working classes. And they have a voracious appetite for reading. So Reynolds panders, I mean, this is one of the words that was used, panders to this taste for sensation, for revelation, for expose, for excitement.
Throughout Dickens' Bicentenary Fever, I felt that the glare of birthday candles was blinding us to a more shaded and textured view of 19th century London. Dickens's characters tend to monopolise our notions of the period, and sometimes it's hard to hear beyond all the bumble and chumble and fuzzy wiggery of the Dickensian universe. I've returned to Reynolds now to explore a Fagin-free alternative, and also to ask why this alternative view has been lost. In his early career, Reynolds often imitated his prosperous peers, blending in like a chameleon with their successes. But maybe camouflage isn't the best way to dress for your date with posterity. So who was the enigmatic George Reynolds? Louis James, emeritus professor at the University of Kent, has unearthed many of the slim fragments of Reynolds's biography. But first, Ian Haywood again.
He went to Sandhurst to do officer training, but as soon as he got the opportunity, he skipped, you know, he got swept up in the politics and the culture of Paris in the 1830s. He opened a bookshop for expatriates in Paris. He's not very good at managing money, so he's often in debt. So this is regarded as part of his kind of fecklessness and lack of responsibility.
Reynolds was quite clearly rebelled against all kinds of authority. His first novel was called The Parricide, and it's about killing your father. And I think when he broke away from Sandhurst, we don't know why, he clearly was up to something which the authorities didn't like. And when he was breaking away, he was clearly a very rebellious person. And he constantly quarrelled with people all the way through his life. He joined the teetotal movement and then very quickly quarrelled with the leaders and then started turning against them. He quarrelled with the Chartists. By 1850, he was a bad name with the Chartists, although in 1848 he was their hero. He seemed to be a very irascible person.
From the Bucks Advertiser and Aylesbury News, the 26th of April, 1851. The name of G.W.M. Reynolds stands first on the programme. He is the leader of this new thing. The Lamartine of the English Revolution is to be Reynolds. The name that is to head the Commonwealth and strike off the heads of the aristocracy is Reynolds. And who is this Reynolds? Why, a filthy-hearted, low-minded fellow who, for the edification of the people, sends forth pictures of women half-naked and indulges the people's brutal taste in the lowest writing that can descend to the pothouse.
I visualise him as a man who regards himself as respectable, as in many ways a gentleman. All the portraits we have of him show him as well-dressed. If you didn't know who he was, you would assume, I guess, he was a Victorian gentleman.
A respectable middle-class man, no question about that.
Professor Anne Humphreys at City University of New York co-edited with Louis James a book of essays on Reynolds.
He's not bearded in any of these pictures. His hair is well trimmed. He has round glasses. That's one of the most characteristic aspects of his picture, is he wears these round glasses.
But there are some problems in this, in that he peddled his own portrait very prominently on his own periodicals and liked to see himself as a very suave, handsome person. In fact, I think he was probably somebody who was quite ordinary to look at. We have got no descriptions of him that I know of, apart from these portraits.
I usually see Reynolds as sat at his desk, you know, dreaming up these many plots for the Mysteries of London and relishing the fact that he can basically do what he likes in his fiction. I mean, he can, you know, bring in all his kind of fantasies about, you know, the evils of the aristocracy and so on to play in his fiction.
But you would not take him for the softcore pornographer or any of the other epithets that were put on him by his contemporaries and some of the early 20th century critics of his work.
And then the other image I have of him is as this incredibly busy proprietor of newspapers and periodicals, buzzing around the office, talking to his reporters, talking to the illustrators, deciding just how much bare breast you're going to show in this particular issue. Are you going to show, you know, an abortionist with fetuses in bottles, and now you're going to show people being hanged and dug up, and, you know, this must have been just great fun, absolutely great fun. I'm sure he had a great time.
The point about his life, which I find very important, is that he always was faithful to his wife and his children. He adored his children.
I've come to Paris because, really, one can't understand the career of George Reynolds without understanding the impact that the French capital has had upon his life.
He was married to Susanna, and it's been said that they actually met while Reynolds had a brief period in prison in Paris.
So just past the high-end shopping boutiques, there's a blue circular sign, and this is perhaps the closest Reynolds is going to get to a commemorative blue plaque. It reads, St. Michael's Church Services in English. So in the heart of sort of the new Bond Street of Paris, there is this demure sign leading us to St. Michael's Church, which was the church where Reynolds was married in 1835 to his wife, Susanna. The story is that she gave birth only 2 months later. So it seems to be one of the main anchor points to try and fix Reynolds in space and time. And yet, of course, the general effacement of Reynolds from history seems to have struck again, because there seems no external signs that this is a religious building. It looks more like a 1970s office block. Condé Nast has its offices here, and the sign reads that the church is on the first floor.
Basically, this building here dates from the mid-70s.
There's a sign listing the days of the communion every Sunday. The assistant curate is Reverend John Moore, and the chaplain here is Reverend Philip Mount Stephen.
The old church was on this site, and it was built in about 1834, I think, sometime. I'll show you the pictures of the old church. Up on the walls here. So, there we are.
We're looking at the old church, the original church where Reynolds would have been married. It seems to be sort of Gothic. How do you describe
absolutely,
that?
Absolutely. It was kind of 19th century neo-Gothic confection, really. as you see it then, that was not called St. Michael's Church, but that was the British Embassy Chapel. Certainly at the time that your guy was here, it would have felt in many ways like an outpost of empire. People talked about the English colony in Paris. You can see the Union Jack flying there.
He lived there as a young man, and it was where he sort of went to re-identify himself, in a sense, to distance himself from his family, from his military background.
Dr. Barry Chivasco is a research fellow at University College London.
And it's where he started his writing career, where he also fell foul of debt, etc. So it's an important part of his own biography.
And what was Paris like at that time in the 1830s, 1840s, as a big bustling city?
No, well, bustling, yes. Big, perhaps less so than now. And also full of political turmoil and change. 1830, of course, we saw the July monarchy come in. And it was not unlike London in that it suffered from cholera epidemics. It had a new urban population. The two cities do, in some respects, parallel each other in terms of having a huge new literate population during that period. But it was full of the similar sorts of social problems that we get familiar with in the 19th century. Urban poor, ghastly living conditions for them, political turmoil, all those things were bubbling under the surface.
I've come now to the Museum of Romantic Life. It's a lovely old French house. There are portraits of the famous figures of this period. We're under the portrait of Ernest Renan, a renowned teacher, philologist and author. I'm here with Judith Leoncan, a professor of French history.
I mean, Paris was a city where poverty was something very visible, especially the center of Paris, the Ile de la Cité and the areas around the Louvre and the Tuileries and the Marais. And Paris was not like a gentrified city like today. It was a very mixed city. And something that traumatized completely the bourgeois and the wealthiest part of the French Parisian population was the cholera of 1832, where in fact people discovered that Paris was a very dirty, dangerous, pathological city. And it was really something that then was destroyed after the 1848 uprising and the revolution. And when Baron Haussmann, who was the préfet of Paris, decided really to clean the center of Paris, making these large, perfect streets. But the Ile de la Cité, and there are still some very narrow streets that you can find, where was completely poor, dirty, overpopulated, and probably a little dangerous.
In the early 1800s, Parisians loved to freak themselves out with the works of English Gothic writers. And this vogue for horror coincided with